Hey everybody, Niels here with the next batch of pre-show announcements. Our giveaway has ended and the winners have been contacted, and we wanted to thank all of you for participating and supporting us. As we are still in vacation pre-recording, this episode is also a little more chaotic and caught on time. We realize that this might be hurting our discussions a bit and hope that you still enjoy them as they are right now. Trust me, we are working on fixing it. And the pre-recording allows us to get a lot more editing time to make the episodes even that more high quality. We hope you enjoy this episode on the importance of player and party composition. Hello and welcome again to WDM Pod, where Emil and I talk about TTRPGs, meta stuff, and everything in between or not.
Yeah.
So, did anything happen to you this week?
Some stuff happened, yes. I've had a few sessions again. But the one I want to talk about is Sunday's session. Because I talked about that my group last week, because we had to do some rescheduling, went to this gate in the mountains, right?
Yes.
And they made plans for how to get into that gate. And they decided that they have a lot of ideas, right? They have a lot of options. They could infiltrate by sneaking past the guards, but I made it clear to them that there is no way inside this mountain pass without either climbing the side of a mountain or through that gate. And then they said, okay, maybe we can talk our way in there. We can convince them that we are part of their organization. I was already like, no, you can't really. Like,
yeah.
The thing is, my players knew that those bandits are not just simple bandits anymore, but rather freedom fighters, revolutionists, extremists, and maybe even terrorists.
Yeah, sneaking into that is... hard.
The problem is, talking your way into that is harder. How do you talk your way? Like, you can walk up to those gates and say, yeah, I'm part of your group. They will ask you, okay, why are you here? Because my players know they have a command structure. There is someone giving orders to them. So they would like to know who's giving orders to them, right?
Yeah.
So my players all know this. Maybe they don't really have this. Like, my players have this problem that they don't take up a lot of information I put in front of them sometimes. Like, I say, okay, this group has a commander. This commander gives actions and tells them to report to the other commander. This implies that there is command structure, that there are commanders, that there are people that have actually a say. They are not just a group of people doing stuff. Like, this is something they know. But they forget that from time to time. Like, they know they have commanders and they expect there to be commanders wherever they go. But they never stop to think about what does it actually mean that they have commanders.
Disregarding information you got.
It's not disregarding information because they didn't get information.
Thinking about it too much. Yeah. Like, or not working with the information you got at the moment. So they know that there is a command structure, but planning something that would require more knowledge on the command structure without having the knowledge on the command structure could be potentially problematic.
The problem is the exact opposite. I see where you have this same problem with over-planning. They don't take that information to planning. Like, I tell them, this group has a commander. This group does too. They all have commanders. So what my brain says, they know they have commanders. My players know these groups have commanders. What my players don't think about is they have commanders. They never stopped and thought about this, like, information that I have given to them. This is if implying this is implying information. I tell them something, and I tell them some other thing, and those two things imply something. Like this, like X. I'm thinking of a good example that is not those bandits. The group they saw traveling, those bandits, right? They are boys from the around the place. Like they lived here. They grew up here, right?
Mm-hmm.
So why would people that have grown up in this place revolt against the crown? Then I tell them that since a few weeks, commerce and trading has been low. So probably money too. So probably also jobs. Now when they connect those two, people are revolting. Money is short. What does that imply? Right? Like, yes. I don't have to tell them that that is the basis of a civil war brewing. But, as the DM, no one ever in the game to them said this is a civil war. This is something that I expect them to find out themselves. That every hint they have gotten so far leads to a civil war. But
yeah, connecting those hints.
Yeah, they don't connect hints enough to get the information that's actually important. I imply a lot of important information because it has never quite been said. Like, there is a lot of information of who the leader is already. He is tactical. He is strategic. He has money. But it was never said, his name was never said. But maybe my players already know who he is if they would connect the dots more. That's what I mean. They know this information, but I can't give it to them because they haven't thought of it and nobody in the world around them has thought of it. I expect my players in this campaign to be the ones that are the ones connecting the dots. They are supposed to be the ones that have the that make this new information. They are supposed to be the detectives, right?
Yeah.
They need to find the information and connect the dots. Yeah.
Yeah, then you can't just blatantly say
what it is. They made their plans and try to sneak in. Got the information that they needed and are now reforming a new plan. With the new information they have gotten. And I won't talk about this because my group is obviously still in play with this. So if I now talk about that information, that could maybe spoiler them. And I don't want to do that.
Yeah, so, that would take the fun out of it.
Yeah. So something that more or less concerns us both is the Euro 2020 has started.
Yeah.
It's officially in full swing. Football or soccer for our American friends has started in Europe again, which is
good. International championships in Europe, I think, would be the translation, right?
It's the Euro. I think it's only called Euro.
But I think our first opponent. The first opponent of Germany would be France.
Was France.
Yes, right. Was. And then the next one was Portugal. And I think we have Hungary with them.
Yeah, our group is France, Portugal, Hungary and us.
Yeah. That's a tough one.
Well, I don't expect us to get first in this group, let's say that.
Yeah, definitely not.
No, I definitely don't. I think France is the obvious favorite. And we have seen why France is the favorite, obviously.
They are the current world champion, if I remember correct.
Yeah, they are.
Yeah.
2018 that they win.
Yeah,
that
should be...
Yeah, that's correct. I know it. Like, I don't watch a lot of football, but It's the Euro or the European Championship and the World Cup. Those are the two I watch, and also
same here.
Like, those are just things that I think, especially in European culture, it's normal to like football, at least to some degree. Like, I never liked like playing it or really watching it till I was like 12 years or 13 years old. Then it was something, yeah, obviously I can play football with my friends. Obviously I can watch the game of our country. Because I think what I realized at that point, more or less passive or even actively, was that football is a way to connect with people because so many people like it.
Yeah, for me, for example, it isn't that I like to watch the sport per se, but I like the social connections and interactions during international competition in sports. And that is what is really huge here in Germany, especially in football / soccer.
Probably every year. Like again, this is something I think a lot of, like, for Americans, maybe you don't want to compare the Super Bowl to our European Championship, but it's exactly like that.
Yeah, it is. It is insane.
It is exactly like that. Like this coming together, watching at home if you can, or even just watching on your own, but seeing the stadium, obviously not filled because of the COVID restrictions in every country, but seeing people play sports is interesting. Like a lot of people say that they don't watch sports because it's boring, but honestly, I think they're wrong. I think watching sports can be quite interesting, not particularly Definitely. For the sport it is, but for the experience it is to watch.
Exactly, the whole experience and social interactions around you watching this sport event.
A lot of people always say culture brings people together, but think about music, games, culture, history, but never about sports. Sports is a big part of culture too.
I
only heard people basically say sport is just for fun, but culture, like, I have a lot of people like hate on sports in general for what it is, but it's exactly the same as art, music. It's a form of, it's part of every culture.
Yeah, and it is some sort of cultural exchange even. Which is a huge part for us, especially in the World Cup, but also in the Euro 2020 coming up.
Yeah, definitely.
In every sort of international competition, there's a huge part of cultural exchange between the combatants of the sports event.
Yeah, it's just, like, again, I like also seeing the sport itself. I like seeing high-profile athletes competing.
Yeah, that's always fun.
I think I also have to speak up on a somber note once for this. Mm-hmm. The game of Denmark, where Eriksen, one of Denmark's players, collapsed on the field. Which was quite scary. I won't recommend watching that online. I don't want to tell you to go watch this moment, because it's a horrible moment of European sports history, that one of the best players of Denmark collapses on a field while playing. Kudos to all those medics, to all the people that helped reanimate him, to all the players for both teams stopping play, not caring about, like, a lot of when you watch football, a lot of people obviously joke about that players scream like every 2 seconds that they got fouled or something. Yes, that's part of the sport, and it's kind of a little bit of pity. But in that moment, seeing someone that is more or less your friend or your compatriot or your opponent, like seeing them taking from the top again, like seeing those people stop everything and only caring about the person that is on the ground, really
yeah, that's a powerful moment.
That's a powerful moment. And I, again, those medics that tried to reanimate him and actually did reanimate him in the end, like, thank you to them for doing that. Yeah. from everyone. Like, that was a scary moment, but it also showed that everyone is human and that everyone is vulnerable, but also that a big part of coming together, that this is only competition and that those are still people. They have connections, they are humans, they have compassion for their opponents. This is not they don't hate each other, even if it looks like that on the field, but as soon as something gets serious, they stop. Because
yeah, that's
this is just important. Sportsmanship. This was like that moment was so scary and sad, but it also was, I think, a moment of very powerful sportsmanship by everyone involved. By it was a strong moment for everyone. And I best of wishes to Ericsson on a recovery. Thoughts with his family, obviously, for witnessing that scary moment. Yeah, that I think that moment actually kind of even changed me a bit. It was something I didn't expect to see, and didn't want to see after I've seen it. Like I had to switch away when they were on the when he was still lying on the ground, but after all, seeing all the reactions, seeing those players from a different side, they're not a competing but compassionate and friendly side to each other, especially from team to team. That was also very strong, and I hope everyone involved is now well and this never happens again to any of them, not to any player, to Ericsson himself, obviously not, yeah, to his family in general, to never to, see that,
yeah, to nobody. It's,
yeah, like
it's just nah.
No, like it showed me that everyone is vulnerable, that a heart attack can hit everyone at every age, no matter who you are. Yeah, and I'm incredibly happy that he and everyone involved is okay again, that everything is
that's good
again, at least from what it looks
as
like
good
right
as
now.
It can be.
Yeah. Okay.
On a more lighter note.
Woo!
I had a session recently where I played my homebrew race. The Half Oni.
Yeah, we talked about that before, right?
Yeah. We talked about how I created the character, and I am a wizard.
Mm-hmm.
And being a wizard, as you usually are, I have the most hit points and basically are the tank of the group right now.
That's still okay.
At level 5.
Yeah.
I have 42 hit points, I think.
Yeah.
Totally
normal.
Yeah, the rest of our group consists of a rogue and 3 rangers, and
well,
me as a wizard.
Those are not classes that have high HP normally, anyway.
Yeah, right, but the D6 wizard.
Yeah?
Yeah.
What's your constitution score? Your modifier?
16.
Oh, okay.
Plus 3.
Yeah, okay, yeah, okay.
And I rolled really high. I rolled a 6, a 6, and two, a 6, a 6, a 5, and a 5.
Yeah, okay. I mean,
a lot.
That's just very high HP. That's okay.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
it's okay as a wizard to fill that role in the party, right?
Yeah, definitely. And it seems like I knew it before I had made the before I rolled the HP, because I chose some melee spells here, some defensive spells here and there, something that doesn't provoke opportunity attacks and stuff like that. obviously mage armor and shield, blah 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 blah. All that defensive stuff that you could use in melee
combat. What a wizard are, what kind of wizard are you? What subclass?
Unearthed Arcana Onomancy Wizard.
Okay, because an Abjuration Wizard would be basically a full-time tank.
Yeah, but I like the thing of with true names and charming people using their true names and being able to weave magic around them just using, just talking and using their name.
I can see that, yeah. No, that's... That's been in UA for a long time, right?
Yeah. I played a Onomancy Wizard before.
Yeah, in my group.
With you.
But that was 2 years ago.
Yeah, at least.
That's the thing.
Yeah.
How was that? How was playing the tank while being a wizard?
It was fun. Because we had some sort of encounter with an jade golem sort of thing protecting some sort of magical item beneath a forgotten temple. But the DM planned some things before she knew what type of characters we were all playing. And the Onomancy Wizard has the opportunity to extract the real or true name of a being. So I tried to extract the true name of the golem, which I did, and cast a spell on him using his true name. But it was planned that using the true name of the golem would stop him, because only the masters and producers of that golem knew his true name. So every time he heard his true name from someone, it is obvious he is your new master. So we got around that encounter pretty easy, which was nice. But yeah.
I mean, those are the moments I look for in D&D too.
Yeah, it's just awesome.
Those are the moments, because that's because why I, as a DM, normally plan a little bit with the characters, because then I can create especially these moments, right?
Yeah.
Like, I would have planned the same thing to happen if I would have known you would have played an Onomancer. Because that shit is cool. Because if you can't, you still have to fight. But if you do, you get a golem.
Yeah. So it was a little weird because we fought some time and then I remembered, wait, I can do this. Let's try it. And he was nearly on his feet already and then he just kneeled and stopped.
Nice.
Looking at me and expecting something.
Nice.
But then the group just said, yeah, crush. a little weird, but yeah.
Nice. Well, nice. That's funny. That's a cool story.
But I just felt so powerful as the character when a fucking golem, and as a half only I'm already like 6'8", 7 feet tall, something along those lines, and the golem was eight to 8.5 feet, and he just fucking kneels before me. Yes.
Bow down before your master.
Exactly that. So, you heard about my character, and you heard about the composition of our characters, and that, I think, leads to a good
wayside into our topic today.
Exactly.
So, before we, though, talk about actual composition of characters, what's, as a DM, when you DM, what's your ideal group size for any TTRPG, and why?
For me, it would be around 4 to 5 players.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think 4 to 5 five is the maximum I can manage pretty easily without having to overplan everything and stuff like that. But with 4, you still have enough variation between your class, race, blah, 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 to have an interesting mixture and a person for every opportunity that you need. So everybody has something they shine in.
Okay. Do you think that that reasoning that you like 5 to 4 players around that margin, could this tie into your playstyle as a DM in some way? Like, do you as a DM create stories that would be best played with 4 to 5 players?
Yes and no. If I don't know how many people I am playing with yet, because I'm just writing some ideas into some sort of adventure that I might like to use later, I plan around 4 to 5 players. But in general, before I start planning anything story-wise, I sit down with my players, see how many they are, and then start to plan around it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So in general, I adjust my stories to the group size I have. But if I don't know the group size yet, I plan around 4 to 5, with around 4 to 5 people.
Okay, for me, the ideal group size is, I think, 6 is the one I manage the most.
Mm-hmm.
6 is the amount of players I manage the most. 3 to 4 is the least I want to manage.
Mm-hmm.
And I think personally 6 is also the best for me. This is because with the 6 I have this big variation that you talked about already. I have a lot of people that can do stuff, and they are basically always different from each other. I never have a full cleric party, right?
You don't have the A-man.
No. But also, I think 6 players is my idea. Like, 6 and 5 isn't so much of a difference, right? But this could... My playstyle is a lot that I... we have a lot of tactical combat. A lot of combat that is very, very intricate in every move. It's not just a hit and the next one hits and the next one hits. It's a lot of combinations. When you think about it,
yeah,
and a lot of me giving my players room to work with and do cool stuff in the combat, that way 6 players is better because they have more combinations, they have more opportunities to use those cool things. So I don't know if either the group size pushed me to that playstyle or always was my playstyle, right? But yeah. I think it benefits both. Like, the big group size is good because then I can use all the things I have in combat. All the things in combat are good because I have so many players, right? It's a win-win for both sides of this argument. It's
something like along those lines, what came first, the chicken or the egg?
Yeah.
With your play style or the group size. After a lot of time, you probably aren't sure anymore what came first and so on. So they just sprung into existence at the same time. Something like that.
Something along those lines. I don't know when they sprung into existence, but I just think that it works for me right now, so I'm going to stick with it for now. So we both like when we talk D&D, right? And obviously we don't normally only talk D&D, but D&D has a given group size of like... 4. 4 is said to be the average party size.
Yeah.
And this is now
the standard and every
the standard I will talk thing. About because now let's say just 4 is the standard, not even for D&D but for all. 4 players at your table while you are the DM. So, what is if you have fewer than those players? What does that provide? Advantages and disadvantages and stuff like that.
Yeah, I think one big advantage would be if you play a story-rich campaign, that you have a lot of opportunities for each individual to shine in role-playing opportunities with your NPCs.
I want to intersect there right now. Yeah. Sorry. The thing is, I agree. I can say that.
All right.
But in a different way, I think, because what you said is that people can, that everyone has opportunities to shine. That they also do when I play with six or seven people. But, wait, the point is now. When you only have two players, I play in a two-player campaign. Only two players and one DM. We always do all the stuff together. There is no separating the group. There is no splitting the party. So everyone takes part in every action.
That's what I meant.
Okay,
Not good with words. But, you have the opportunity that everyone is always in the spotlight.
Yeah.
That would be the correct way to phrase it, probably.
There is no... This is his... Like, obviously, in that campaign, I had my few sessions where I was more important than the other one, and he was more or less a supporting character. Then there were sessions where he was the main character, and I was supporting him, and stuff like that. But, yeah, when you only have two or three players, like we have in the Witcher campaign, for example...
Yeah.
There is no...
Everything achieved is together.
There is no splitting, right? There is no... Yeah. Like... That's something a six-player party has as a disadvantage, in my opinion. Because my six-player party has simple, smaller groups inside of this party. They have the two chaos people. Two chaotic, evil idiots that don't have a problem murdering someone. But they also have the lawful good wizard that stands next to that and says no. Now, in a three-player party, obviously there are still... moments where you split. But I don't talk about splitting the party in a dungeon and going left or right or something. I'm talking about really splitting spotlight, right? You have sessions where or moments where the others are just not there that are important. Those usually don't happen. So that's basically the big advantage that, in my opinion, that smaller groups provide, because everyone is always in part of the action.
Mm-hmm.
But the big disadvantage, in my opinion, is combat. If you have smaller groups, then what is normal for the group size of this table or the book you're playing, right? If a book says there are four people recommended to play and the book is balanced for four people, then... having fewer than four people throws balancing out of the window. But also, if your table is used to playing with five people or six people and you now only play with two, you need to change your approach to any skill check encounter completely. Any rolling needs to be changed.
Definitely, you have to think a lot more about what to do, because there isn't that much room for failure. Because if you play with two characters and one fails, that's 50%. That's a lot. But if you play with, for example, as in my group, seven players and one fails, that's just, all right. In a group check, he fails. Big deal. Most of the time, they can compensate for that. But in the two-player party, not so much.
Yeah. Like in the two-player party, since with your buff wizard, right? He is supposed to fill the group's role of tank.
At least for now.
Yeah, but the thing is...
Yeah.
If you only had two players in that group, you would still need to fill that group of tank. Maybe that role of tank, but maybe not with the moniker of being a tank, but just being the one that hits, that gets hit. Being the one that fights up front. Because with two players, you have to somewhat more think about what roles need to be filled. And with smaller groups, some roles might not even get filled. Let's talk about this. What roles even are there?
If you go classic, you have the basic tank.
Yeah.
For example, like in D&D, barbarian,
paladin
would be the barbarian, paladin, fighter, something along those lines.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Then you have the classic mage either damaging or support. It would be something like, for example, cleric, wizard, for the support thing, thingamabobs, or damage damage wise would probably be warlock or
sorcerer. Yeah. Adding to that,
of course, you can mix and match those because of different types of spells, but obviously, if you just take the stereotypical,
I'm not saying that the sorcerer has to always be the damage caster, right? What we are saying is that there are certain group roles to be filled, and those roles aren't I'm a sorcerer or I'm a paladin. Those are they can even be
the damage caster.
They can even be more unique or abstract than even being I am a damage caster. Simply, being I am damage, I am tank, or I am you can obviously put this in I am a frontline, I am backline, I am damage, I am not damage, I'm utility, and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So you have people that have to provide some sort of tankiness, in my opinion. If it comes to combat, you have to have some people that can provide some sort of tankiness. Those can either be people that can dodge attacks, take attacks, but don't get hit from them in D&D, have a high armor class, or have a lot of HP and soak up the damage. Those are all three valid options to take to get aggro from an enemy. You need to be the ones that draw focus. Then you have the people that provide utility, people that can buff or debuff, people that can heal, and all that stuff. So that's also a role you kind of have to fill. You may need to have someone that can heal someone, because the tank you have up front needs to be healed at some point. Yeah, so you have these roles you have, right? And it doesn't matter how many roles you actually do have, or how many roles now we both now can put down on the table and tell you about. Mm-hmm. That's not important here. The important thing is you have these roles. And I think in every TTRPG you play, you kind of can fill those roles in some form or another. They are always sort of roles. If you have Lancer, for example, a mecha sci-fi game, you have someone that can repair those mechs, and that might be needed because no one else can. You may have someone that can pilot mechs. Maybe everyone can, but that's the thing. You have every game that provides you with a list of skills also provides you with a list of stereotypes you can fill. If you have a mechanic skill, someone that can repair stuff, you automatically have someone. You need to have someone, if that repair skill becomes important, that has that repair skill. If it isn't important to how you play your game, then no one needs to fill that role. Like if you play a game with a mechanic skill, but never use it, filling that role is useless. But if that mechanic skill is needed for the game, that is a role that needs to be filled. And smaller groups might not provide enough people to fill every role that is needed to play the game, which then again provides a very interesting story opportunity. Because some ways are just blocked for you to solve problems. So, yeah, that's why in most games, there are, like, when you look at games, you can more or less see how many people you need to play with, in my opinion. When I look at this, I can estimate how many people I would need to make this game interesting, so we can actually go in every direction of this game, have every area down and on paper with everyone. For example, the Dark Eye parts all their skills into 5 different classes, let's say that. Nature, social intelligence, physical, and crafting. Those are five different things. And now you can say we have a group of 5 party members that have expertise in exactly one of those 5 subjects. Boom, you have more or less filled every role that the party needs in this game. You can play the game without actually losing on anything in the game. If you have a bigger group, well, it's obvious you may overfill, which is also very interesting.
Yeah, there can be some competitiveness between
competitiveness, they can become best friends just because they like the same flowers. That's also possible. That's, again, this you can use nearly everything to a story opportunity, but you have this party composition, and I advise every player, because I don't play usually often. I don't play often. And when I created, for example, the character for the Call of Cthulhu campaign I'm playing on stream with Doug from Nerdy Excursion, Cody Garrett Wells, Josh from TX's Out, and Hope for TTRPGs, I said I don't have a character idea yet. I only know that I want to play the person that is the last one in the room, so someone that makes sure everyone gets out. A protector kind of person. Not a tank per se, but someone that makes sure that we survive this game. Because Call of Cthulhu is a game of surviving, right? Someone that makes sure we survive this game. So he has a gun. He is not particularly the best in that regard of being mental, but he is the one that tries to remain calm-headed, cold-headed, and in the game and get everyone safe. So that's the role I am looking to fill in that game. To be a protector of some kind. That's the role I'm filling. That's part of a party composition. And then when I'm a protector, you usually, now that again, this is, you can name those roles however you want. Those role names are arbitrary. Those, what the roles are is game specific. But every game has these roles. Every game, where you have some sort of list of skills, I can tell you, when I make a character and I don't have every skill at level 10 and are basically an expert in it, I need help from someone that is an expert in the other skills I don't am expert. So, there you have two roles at least. Boom. Then probably a third, a fourth, a fifth, a sixth, and seventh, and so on and so forth. So, that is a party composition in my opinion, right?
Then we talked about party compositions a lot right now.
Mm-hmm.
Then I would like to ask you a question.
Yes, please do.
What are player compositions?
Oh, player compositions, however, are rather interesting to me. Player compositions is what I used to call every group has their own chemistry, right? Every party you play in the games, every character, they have connections to the other ones. They have relationships. They might hate each other. They might love each other. They are friends. They are comrades, whatever. But a player composition is the exact same thing, but for players. Having players that connect with each other. Having the composition of players. Having a group of players and the chemistry between them is the composition we are talking about here. So maybe even player chemistry would be a better word for this.
Hmm.
That's what I mean.
So something like the guy who always brings pizza kind of thing.
Yes.
And for example.
Yeah, obviously.
The one who always makes jokes or puns about things that happen in the game.
Yeah.
And stuff like that. Just keeping up morale and stuff like that.
To anyone, look at your five best friends, at your friend group, at your best friend group. Close your eyes and look at them in your imagination. Or open your eyes if they are sitting right next to you while you listen to this episode. And look at them. And you probably can put every one of them into some sort of box. I am not talking about a box like this person is X or Y, but everyone has their role in your group. One of you is probably the smartest. One of you is probably also the fittest. Now these are also stereotypes again, right? I don't want you to just think in stereotypes, but one of you probably is the smartest one. One of you is smart, and they might be the ones that you passively just look up to when you have a question, because they are probably the most, the ones that answer those questions the most. That's just it. And that's totally fine. That's a composition. You have found someone that is smart, because this sounds dumb. Maybe you aren't, right? But I'm not saying you're dumb, but you have this person that is smart in the group for a reason, because they are a friend and they fill a certain role in that group. Maybe the role of being the smartest one, or being the fittest one, or being the funny one, or whatever, again, whatever role you want to put them in. But there probably is one. So, question to you. Why is this composition or chemistry so important to playing TTRPGs?
Because playing TTRPGs is basically a giant social thing.
Mm-hmm.
And if there is no harmony at the table outside of the game cannot function the way it is supposed to. Mm-hmm. I think. Because if you fight, for example, out of game, you can't really get back into the game and focus on that, what is or is supposed to be fun for everyone, because mm-hmm. some measly little thing between interpersonal things
interpersonal
is blocking that
stuff.
Things, yeah.
The force.
That would be one thing. And you can play with all different kinds of people, but if two of those don't like each other, that is difficult.
They will make it hard for everyone at the table.
Exactly. Even if if they like everyone but one, that's difficult.
Yes.
Because they pull everyone everybody else in there mm-hmm. with them.
Mm-hmm.
That's would be my opinion on that topic.
Yeah. Obviously, you can also play with random people online on Roll20 you have never met before. There also exists some chemistry. You might not be able to put them into boxes in your friend group or into roles, but those are still people, and no chemistry is better than bad chemistry in this instance. You don't know this person. You don't have any prejudice against them. So
yeah, it's just a neutral mindset you can.
Yeah, it's a neutral mindset. You all go in like. The first thing is, when I play a game with my friends, the first thing I want there to be is that everyone at the table is actually here to play the game. This is the first thing. And this is something that those stranger groups online definitely have. Because the only thing that is actually supposed to be is, hey, we are a group that wants to play D&D or whatever TTRPG we want to play. That's the first thing. That's the first thing I want from my players. Everyone at the table should be fine with playing today. I don't want you to come to my table saying, oh, I don't want to play today. Then just tell me that you don't want to come, and I will tell you that I don't want you at my table at that day. I hate it if players come and don't enjoy themselves. I think, as a DM, I am doing something wrong. Telling me
but
outright, hey, I don't have the spoons to play today. I need to get some rest. Can I skip? I might be offended that you skip. Yes, but I would also be way more offended if you come to my table and just don't do anything. And just don't acknowledge that what I created for you. Telling me I'm sorry, I can't make this week. I don't have the spoons. I don't have the energy. I'm like, okay,
that's it's not a problem if we know about it,
as
DMs, but we got to know about it.
That's the thing for me. I'm very understanding if my players cancel sessions, because I think they always have a reason, because I've never had them cancel just for not wanting to play. The thing is always like, there's always a reason behind it. Like, if they don't want to play because they didn't have enough sleep, I can understand them not having enough sleep, right? But this is a hard thing. It's a case-by-case basis for me. because I can't just say I want you all to be there every time, but like make exceptions then. My tables, because they are only friend groups for me, I never played with strangers online, really. At least not real strangers. But normally I only play with my friends, my IL friends. I know that they want to play. And this is the first thing I want as a DM. Players that actually want to play the game. This is the first thing that is important for a player composition and player chemistry. This ensures that everyone wants to at least have fun that day while playing.
Yeah. And this makes a lot of things easier.
Yes. So, everyone should come with the mindset of wanting to have fun to the table, right?
Yes.
What is also, like you also said, that it's important that the players like each other, right? Or at least don't hate each other. They, in my opinion, the more...
They at least have to tolerate each other to some extent.
The more connection you have with each other, the more you can play together.
Yeah.
The more you know what distances you can go with that person and what not.
Exactly.
What jokes you can crack, which jokes you just can't. You know exactly when they feel offended by you doing something wrong or not, and all that stuff. So knowing each other, player chemistry again, is very important, and not definitely not the only thing that makes player enjoyment and DM enjoyment a thing. Like, not every, like, if you have the mindset of you want to have fun, you come to the table, you have a good connection with everyone at the table, and you then basically you have a formula for fun. Then you have the basis you need. If you don't come with the mindset of having fun, you won't have fun.
Exactly.
If you come to the table with I want to have fun, but other people at the table stop you from having fun, then you don't have fun. And again, this is the most important thing here. We want to have fun. So find a group that ensures your fun. And
one thing about that, actually.
Yeah.
The more fun you have at the table, the more engaged are you within the story.
Yes.
Which then also leads to more fun again. In most cases, let's say.
Yes, 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 exactly.
Because you then just work to get the story forward or the combat forward and have a lot of fun with this, then come to the next thing and just enjoy it as well.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a repeating cycle.
Yes, it's a repeating cycle of just try to have fun, but not only in the game, out of game too.
Yeah, exactly.
You need to enjoy the experience of it all, of the people you play with, the story you craft together, and what you do in that story. Those are all things you need to enjoy. Now, so to summarize, from the top, we've talked about what our most favorite group sizes are, and they are pretty large, you could say. Some people enjoy playing with only two people, and we said, yes, that's also fun. But sometimes there are certain disadvantages to that. There are also disadvantages to our playstyle with big groups, where, like, if you want to have a lot of combat, bigger groups are better because they have more options. If you have,
but
yeah,
they could be worse because it takes a lot more time.
That is something I disagree with. With two players, I'm way more careful in my actions, what I take. While in a six-player group,
you don't have to be so careful with six or seven players because the action economy is just heavily in their favor.
Obviously, yes. If you have six players, it could be that they are all taking generally longer as the two players. But I know my turns are longer if I'm in a less player group, for example. We talked about what a party composition actually is, what roles are in the party composition, and what happens if those roles aren't filled or if they are overfilled, and how important it actually is to have every role filled. Spoiler alert, it really isn't important to have every role filled.
Because not having roles leads to opportunities, or having overfilled a role leads to opportunities as well.
Yeah, Like what you, the only thing you can't do is fill every role on yourself.
Exactly.
Like there are journal RPGs or journal TTRPGs which you play on by your own. That's totally fine. You also have duet play where only one DM and one player. There also the player needs to fill every role there is. But normally these are social games where you play with a group of friends or group of people at least. You don't expect to fill every role. Don't expect to be the hero every time. Expect to have a fun experience. And now comes the most important word. Together.
Yeah.
So
I think most of, or many people forget the thing that they try to craft a story together.
Mm-hmm.
And not just, they are not here for being in the spotlight 24/7.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
but
mm-hmm.
Crafting an awesome story where the story as a whole and bits and bobs of characters are in the spotlight one at a time.
Yes.
And not one all the time.
Yes, exactly. So, this basically concludes this episode, more or less, in my opinion.
Yeah. Mostly, yeah.
Yeah, it was a fun one, in my opinion. It was a very fun one.
Yeah, I think we are a little chaotic. A little is maybe. But, yeah.
Also, we have to say we are right now in the process of pre-recording some episodes because you have vacation in a few weeks and we can't record for like 2 weeks. So, please, everyone, excuse this little bit more chaotic episodes. We try to keep it to a minimum, but we're also a little bit stretched on times that right now and need to record like 2 or 3 episodes a week to get this vacation to don't miss an episode in the vacation time. What we can however promise is maybe after the vacation a little bit more heavier edited episodes where we might do a little bit more editing because of the pre-recording we are doing right now. Look out for that. Again, the schedule won't change for right now. We will have an episode every week for you talking about something different, and we hope again our chaotic discussion in some way or another can give you an opinion. You don't even have to agree with us. If you disagree with us, that's fine. That's totally okay, because well, we are only here to state our opinion on the measures and discuss something. And if our discussion brings you any ideas on something, be it homebrew things or any images you can create in your world, any opinions you have, we have done our job. Our job is not to tell you what to do. Our job is to give you your own opinion. And we do that.
Basically, we are giving you inspiration dice every time we do this.
Yes, we are giving inspiration dice away. Whoa, I never used those.
Yeah, I forget them all the time. But I hope you don't forget our episodes. Hey!
So,
thanks for listening, everyone, and hear you on the next one. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.